The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. I'm Josh Fennett. From the swoops and swells of Oscar Niemeyer's master plan for building Brasilia in the 1960s to Eladio Dieste's undulating grain silos and Luis Barragán's colourful cuboid creations, Latin America's architectural golden age made waves around the world, and it may yet again. In this week's episode, we head to Sao Paulo, Mexico City, and Santiago de Chile to discuss a new crop of LATAM architects who are rethinking the materials of their trade and are unabashed about bending a few rules. Plus, why is LVMH playing musical chairs with its designers? A recap of the fashion shakeups of the past week with our fashion editor. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. So, what are the unique opportunities and problems of working in Latin America? And what lessons can this bring to bear for architects abroad? We asked our correspondent Lucinda Elliott for the take from Sao Paulo.
The welcoming expression, mi casa es tu casa, is perhaps one of the best examples of Latin American hospitality. But up until recently, what the house actually looked like left many observers outside the region bewildered. The continent has a history of producing some strong, well-recognised native architects, but very few throughout the 20th century managed to gain a reputation overseas. That's changing. Talent from Mexico all the way down to the southern tip of Chile is not only being picked out, but also setting an example for the world, combining art, urbanism, and an unrivalled sense of social consciousness. This summer, Mexican architect Frida Escobedo will set a record as the youngest architect to design the Serpentine Pavilion in London in its 18-year history. Her design is for a courtyard enclosed by dark trestled walls made from cement tiles. The technique is a play on the celosía, a typical feature in Mexican architecture that allows air to move through a building, handy in scorching temperatures. She follows Smiljan Radic from Santiago, Chile, who was virtually unknown beyond the continent until he received the Serpentine Commission in 2014 for his delicate fiberglass cocoon.
From outside you see a volume really solid, really opaque, but inside you feel the light inside and you feel the relation with the landscape really close, you know?
Latin America began to draw significant international attention with a milestone exhibition in 2016 at New York's Museum of Modern Art. That year, the Institute declared that post-war buildings in Central and South America rivaled architecture in the United States and Europe, both in quantity and quality. Buildings found nestling in tropical urban jungles like Caracas and Rio de Janeiro boasted a combination of concrete, colour, and adapting to the climate that was both rooted in the modernism of the West and entirely distinct from it. Not to mention the construction of Brasilia, the Brazilian capital, by local architect Oscar Niemeyer in the late 1950s, that came to symbolise Latin America's outsized ambitions and pioneering spirit.
So, ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce the 2016 Pritzker laureate, Alejandro Aravena.
Chilean architect Alejandro Aravena was awarded the most prestigious architecture accolade in the world that same year in 2016, the Pritzker Prize.
Tonight, I have the honor to announce that the Games of the 31st Olympiad are awarded to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
And by August, the major infrastructure developments and influx of buildings to accommodate the Summer Olympic Games were on show to serve an international entourage in Rio de Janeiro. Giancarlo Massanti, the Colombian architect, snapped up the competitive Next Landmark contest for the region too. The MoMA show that year emphasised how LATAM was home to vast, open spaces that were late in urbanising. So architects were given free rein to use their imaginations in ways they couldn't in centuries-old European cities or even in established towns along the eastern coast of the United States. And that still stands today. Regional governments, particularly ones with oil and industrial wealth, such as Mexico, have dedicated funds to develop huge social housing projects, hospitals, libraries and museums, all with local characteristics, rather than hiring a foreign name with international credentials, offering something completely new to the global design scene. Venezuelan architect Jorge Rivas Perez and a curator involved in the MoMA project explained at the time how innovation comes from a desire amongst Latin Americans to be local and at the same time, cosmopolitan and part of the global scene. It's been happening in Latin America since the 1940s, he said, when designers tried to use the vocabulary of modernism, then in vogue, but also recognised a need to adapt it to local materials and to systems of production based on local techniques and traditions. Top award-winning star architects are turning towards Latin America as a destination for their latest projects, also helping to propel the region onto the world stage, mixing new sustainable building techniques with materials found locally. Latin American cities are showing us that they can compete with the look and technology of the world's most advanced cities. The way designers are talking about themselves as a collective group is a notable change. Until the advent of cable television and then the internet, creators and consumers alike were often more aware of trends in the United States and Europe than in nations neighbouring to theirs. Today, intra-regional university exchange programmes, local awards and art fairs hosted for the region in the region are solidifying a distinct Latin American style of architecture. This year, the CAASI Architecture Arts Association is organising a competition specifically for young Latin designers, again underlying the important role played by these countries. In some cases, as much as 90% of design works are still in private collections in their own countries. Hundreds have never been shown in public exhibitions, either at home or abroad. There's a new drive to showcase Latin American talent, as art and design becomes available and accessible to a wider public. This week, São Paulo hosts its International Arts Festival. It's been going for over a decade, but recently opened a whole floor dedicated to Brazilian design. With 33 exhibitors, a timeline will be created on the third floor this week, beginning with colonial furniture, all the way to bold contemporary designs that are conquering the international market. LATAMers have opened their homes, or casas, to the world, and it seems like we're all getting cosy. For Monocle in São Paulo, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
That was our Latin affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott there in São Paulo. Now, one name Lucinda rightly seized upon in that report is that of Frida Escobedo. The Mexican architect this year became the youngest ever to win the commission for London's prestigious Serpentine Pavilion in Hyde Park, and the first woman since the late Zaha Hadid in 2000. Based in Mexico City, Escobedo founded her own studio at just 24 years of age and helmed notable projects such as La Tallera, a former home and studio of the late Mexican muralist David Alfaro Siqueiro, and she converted the space into a museum and covetable cultural space. James Frederick in Mexico City visited the architect's studio to put a voice to an impressive and fast-growing portfolio of work.
On a balmy day in March, I walk to Mexico City's Juarez barrio, where Frida Escobedo's studio sits in an unassuming three-story building. Escobedo founded this studio in 2006, but recently relocated to this clean, bright white space near downtown. She now works here with 9 other staff members, most of them hip 20-somethings drawing away on computers. Upstairs in her office, we started by talking about if Mexico's a good place for young architects.
I think it's a yes and a no. Because yes, if you are willing to take the risks and create your own opportunities, it's a fantastic place because you can really get away with things. Because there are no rules, so you can kind of create them. But financially, I mean, it's super tough because then you have like zero money on your bank account for many, many years. And you just need to find new ways to create jobs, no? Like no one is going to come to your door and say like, oh, make this house for me. Well, some people get that kind of scenario, but it was not our case. We just had to come up with ideas of how to do things, like ask for scholarships, do side projects like research. And I think this generation of artists, curators, architects is very different probably from the previous one where you got like the huge commissions and, you know, like the big projects. And it's about like creating your own opportunities. Going to architecture was almost like an accident, I guess. I was always interested in like the creative fields. I was flirting with art a little bit. I mean, I was good at doing things with my hands while I was growing up. That was very clear. But I felt a little bit intimidated with art. It was something that was too personal. It was like there was nothing to really ground it, and I felt a little bit exposed with that. I thought it was like, okay, architecture is something that has to do with creative field, but it's a little bit more, you know, organized. It has like this purpose, this problem that you need to resolve. And I said like, okay, I'll just try, and if I make a mistake, then I will shift careers. And the first week that I went to architecture school, I was hooked. Like it was perfect for me. It was like something that was probably more intuitive and I really liked, but it was not very clear from the start. I think it all started with this small competition, the Eco Pavilion competition. It was in 2010. That was actually the first project that I did on my own. Like before that, I was doing Hotel Boca Chica with José Rojas, and before that, I was in Perro Rojo with Alejandro Larcón. But this competition came out. That was the first year, and it was to propose a summer pavilion for the courtyard of Museo El Eco. And at the same time, I was looking for a master's degree. Like I was still like searching, and this program came out: Art Design in the Public Domain. It was new at the GSD at Harvard. And I think it was a combination of those two that really just like caught my attention. Like, okay, I saw what you could do with a space like that, even if it was just in a very contained small space, even if it's like super interesting as El Eco. But I was able to get proof of that kind of project. Like what would happen if you create something as simple but as complicated as this? And then the master's degree, which was all about like this combination between disciplines and also like what the public realm is and that the potential of spatial practices, like to expand this idea of architecture. So I think that's where it became like something that I was interested in.
One of the projects she's most famous for is La Tallera. Her daunting task on this one was to turn the Mexican muralist David Alfaro Siqueiros' workshop into a public museum of his magnificent work.
It was a big responsibility. I mean, the space was already public. It was already like a cultural space. It wasn't working that well. That was what they needed to renovate, not just the space, but also the program within it, like reactivate it fully. But to me, it was more about the opportunity to return these murals into like this public art condition. Like he was very vocal about what art should be. This is something that should be accessible to everyone. So it's a bit of a contradiction if you had like these murals behind a door, behind a reception area. So when we just first came into this courtyard and I saw like these two murals facing each other, it was like, okay, this needs to be opened up to the public space. And it was about like taking that risk of losing a courtyard, which could, of course, mean like that I would be out of the competition because you're giving a private space into the public. But at the same time, it was about creating this other condition where you actually get the plaza to incorporate into the project. So you lose a courtyard, but you gain a plaza. And it was also like a matter of understanding how these public buildings sometimes need to be made with very little resources and how you need to play with that idea. Like how do you convince people to use relatively common materials, a cinder block or something that is usually understood, or like it feels like something is not finished when you have like no paint on the walls. And this is a public building, so you have to convince people to do these kind of things. And eventually it worked out really well, and now they really embrace that roughness of the building.
Escobedo was also recently commissioned the Serpentine Pavilion, becoming the first woman since 2000 and the youngest person ever to get the commission.
It was a big challenge. It was like so many names were behind this pavilion and so many great projects that it was really difficult to try to come up with a new idea. Like, how do you do a new iteration of the Serpentine Pavilion when everything has been said and done? So it was a little bit intimidating at first. And then it was like, okay, we just need to say what we do here at the office. What are our preoccupations? What is our approach to space? Like, just tell our story and see how it goes. And of course, we were super surprised when we got the news that we were doing it, and we were thrilled and happy. But I think it was like that combination. Like, okay, you need to identify what needs to happen at the space, but you also need to explain who you are and what you're concerns are. Like, what is your idea of what a temporary structure should be? But of course, you don't know where it's going to end up, you know? So that was the other question. Like, okay, how do you create a space for a client that you don't know, and for a space that you don't know, for a location that you don't know? So it was an opportunity to also experiment with materials, very simple materials again, because this is what we like to do. This is what we know how to do. We use something that's industrial, that's relatively cheap, that is very modular, that it's easy to find. It was also about creating this kind of contained space. So it's not just like a roofed area, it's more like an introvert project. It's creating this kind of courtyard, which is also a notion that is very Mexican, this idea of interiority, of the intimate self versus the public self. We have like this kind of duality, and we play with that a lot. So it was like, okay, we're creating a courtyard inside the park, and therefore you're talking about interior and exterior in a more complex way, because when you're inside the pavilion, you're actually outside the park, but inside the pavilion. And so are you inside or outside, really? And this kind of screen that we created using these roof tiles allows for certain porosity, so you can get glimpses of the park. When I talk with my other colleagues who are living in New York or Europe or even some other places of Latin America, they're really surprised. Like, oh, wait, your friends are architects? Yes. Are you having lunch with architects all the time? Like, most of the time. And we're friends. We're competing one day, you know, for like a project, and the next day we collaborate together. And then if we don't, well, we're having lunch and it's just like having fun. Like, it's not something like when you compete against each other, then you cannot talk to each other. It's a very friendly environment, and I appreciate it a lot.
Mexican architect Frida Escobedo there, speaking in her studio to James Frederick. We also spoke to Escobedo in our design-themed May issue of Monocle magazine, which is on all self-respecting newsstands now. And from design-minded buildings, we turn our attention to a groundbreaking online firm with architecture as its focus. Just over 10 years ago, Chilean architect David Basulto created Arc Daily, a website that's become the world's most visited architecture resource. Santiago-based Arc Daily was created with the aim of spreading architecture news, opinion pieces, interviews, and lesser-known self-submitted projects from around the world, and not least to promote design and talent from Latin America. But what makes this region such fertile ground for talent, both homegrown and international? This show's producer, Daphne Karnesis, recently caught up with David Basulto to find out what's behind a new wave of talent cresting in Latin America.
What the world is seeing now coming from Latin America is something that has been in the making for many years. For example, in the 90s, Chile went through a very good economical growth that provided many opportunities for development and therefore in construction and architecture, that allow architects such as Alejandro Aravenas, Milian Radich, and Cecilia Puga to start their careers. After that, in the country, and same as has happened in Brazil or Colombia, governments have put a very strong focus on building civic infrastructure that have gone into public competitions, opening new opportunities for young and emerging architects. And this process that is not like in Europe or in the US, It has taken a bit of time, but now it has provided a strong base for the architecture to emerge. And I think that architects that we are seeing now coming from, well, Colombia, Paraguay, Chile, Argentina, Peru, and Mexico are part of this new wave of development.
And what do you see in terms of how they're being received and I guess perceived as well in Europe and the rest of the world? We have the example of Frida Escobedo, who won the commission for this year's Serpentine Pavilion. A couple of years ago, there was another Chilean architect, Radic. You know, what are we seeing in terms of, you know, are they finally being recognized more and more?
In a way, we are isolated. We have less resources, and that leads to a particular aesthetics that is driven by necessity. And that generates a special kind of innovation. On the other hand, this still wild continent has a very present geography. So this combination between the landscape, the nature that is very strong, and the need to do more with less has generated a very particular aesthetics. In Latin America, you still have this freedom that in a way is also a constraint, because it's when you don't have enough resources, you have to be more inventive.
Are there any specific, I know it's quite a tricky question, but specific architecture schools or universities in Latin America that you think stand out or that we've seen a good amount of design talent coming from?
Well, I think that, for example, the Escola do Cidade in Sao Paulo is very interesting. It is pushed by a faculty that is very connected with the city, that has high aspirations for the future of Sao Paulo, and they put a lot of passion on what they do. And for me, it is a unique school. On the other hand, you have schools with a long tradition, such as Universidad Católica in Chile, that are producing very, very good students. Most of the Chilean ones that you are hearing about are coming from here. But also there are more small schools that are being more innovative in their curriculum, such as Universidad de Talca, which is located in the south of Chile. It is a rural school where students have to build their graduate projects, and that gives them a very down-to-earth approach on how to do architecture.
And again, a difficult question, but in your opinion, are there a few specific names, you know, young studios that we should be looking out for?
Well, I think that the kind of things that Alberto Moleto is doing, Alejandro Pils, from together with Loreto Lyon, are definitely worth checking out. These are architects with a very, they are from Chile. They have a very strong background on the craftsman of architecture. But also a region that for me is very interesting is Mexico, because Mexico is very diverse. It is an amazingly big country that from down to south, east to west, it has very different architectural scenes. For sure that today names such as Fernando Romero, Michel Rojkin, or Mauricio Rocha, more, let's say, established architects are very well known abroad. But now you start to hear more about people like Frida Escobedo, like Productora, studios that are very young but are doing a very good, interesting local architecture. They are also operating on a global scale, and this is putting Mexico on the map, not just in terms of architectural production, but also discourse and in terms of academy, with our Mexican architects going abroad to teach.
That was David Basulto, founder of Santiago-based architecture website ArcDaily, and himself an architect from the Universidad Católica in Chile. Now, one of the world's largest luxury goods firms, LVMH, has announced several management reshuffles since the beginning of the year. Most recently, last week, when Chris Van Ash, former creative director at Dior Homme, was moved across to the subsidiary Berluti, where he'll work as the brand's new creative director. So what's behind this game of musical chairs? Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters, wades in.
There's been a lot of big changes in the menswear industry this year, a sort of staggering amount of new appointments at big luxury houses. So the most recent one is Chris Van Ash. It's been announced that he will be going to Berluti, where he'll be succeeding Haider Ackermann. Chris Van Ash was previously at Dior Homme, so he's staying within the LVMH group. Kim Jones is going to Dior Homme. He'll replace Chris Van Ash. Virgil Abloh is going to Louis Vuitton. He will replace Kim Jones. Almost all of them have come within the LVMH group, which is interesting. And the other one, which is one of the biggest announcements of the year, is that Eddie Slimane will be coming to Celine. And he will take over everything. He'll oversee all aspects of the brand, including launching menswear, which is sort of very exciting for a lot of guys who love the brand but haven't been able to buy it previously. All of that is within LVMH. Designers do change. It is something that happens fairly regularly, but for the fact that all this to happen in such quick succession, and for so many of these to happen within the LVMH group, the world's biggest luxury group, doing exceedingly well at the moment, the fact they're making all these changes is a telling thing. I think there is a kind of common thread that can be drawn between these designers, and I think that is their appeal to youth culture. They all have some sort of connection to streetwear, like a high-low blend. The most striking case in point is Virgil Abloh going to Louis Vuitton. So he's best known for his brand Off-White. And also he's a longtime collaborator with Kanye West on all his clothes. And he's like one of the masters of streetwear and of building hype around a brand. He's not a trained fashion designer, but there's so much hype around him. He has massive social media followings. His shows, there's always a frenzy outside the Off-White shows. And I think putting him at the helm of Louis Vuitton, this huge Parisian luxury brand, is a really striking move. If you look at the designs that they've kept within the group, Kim Jones, one of the things he was best known for was his collaboration with Supreme, which did exceedingly well. Keeping Chris Van Ash, so Chris Van Ash is now going to Berluti, but even at Dior Homme, you know, he would put trainers on the runway. He featured ASAP Rocky in advertising campaigns. They're all designers that have kind of tapped into that movement. And then if you look at Eddie Slimane, I mean, he's known for his rocker chic, making rockers and that kind of heroin chic aesthetic. He made that really cool, and that is intrinsically linked with youth culture, with skate culture and things like that. I think the fact that all these kind of changes have been made in the last couple of months just really hammers home this point that streetwear and the millennial generation, that consumer, they're perhaps more important than ever before. Brands like Gucci, which are doing extremely well, that's owned by Kering, so it's the competitor. A large part of their success has been based on millennial customers. And then there's research saying things like by 2025, millennials will account for 45% of luxury spend. I mean, it's a huge market. Millennials have a different way of buying. I mean, they've grown up with different kind of influences around them, with social media, etc. So they buy in different ways. So for example, streetwear does a lot of collaborations, a lot of exclusive drops. It is kind of built on a different model. Things like slogans and big prints and things like that, they look very striking on computer screens or iPhone screens. And it's hugely hyped. I mean, Supreme, I was in New York the other week and the queues just go around the block. There's other brands like Kith. Again, queues going around the block. It's like crazy, but it's like a experience now. Like kids will go, that's what they do. They're like, oh, well, let's go shopping. Let's queue up for a few hours and then we'll buy the latest drop. So I think these luxury brands are looking at this and saying, these very influential people, they do have money to spend. They want to spend it. And this is kind of one of the things that they're really interested in. And I think hiring these designers who are able to mix that kind of culture with more traditional luxury elements as well, as someone like Kim Jones does really well. I mean, that tells us the state of the menswear game at the moment.
Our very special thanks to Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis. You can always send her your thoughts and suggestions. Remember, she's at dk@monocle.com. And it was researched by Pierre-Antoine Denis and Megan Atkinson. It was also ever capably edited by Christy Evans. We'll leave you now with a tune from Ecuadorian musician Nicola Cruz, who combines folkloric melodies with a contemporary electronic sound, I'm told. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.